peppers, tomatoes, cucumbers, mushrooms, lettuce, and other salad greens, snow peas, sugar snap peas, and tomatoes. Vegetables for cooking, fresh or frozen. Broccoli, cauliflower, eggplant, mushrooms, tomatoes, cabbage, string beans, kale, Swiss chard, mustard greens, spinach, Brussels sprouts, asparagus, onions, and garlic. Fruits, fresh or frozen. Strawberries, blueberries, raspberries, kiwi fruit, apples, oranges, pineapples, melons, lemons, limes, grapes, pears, bananas, mangoes, plums, peaches, and cherries. Raw nuts and seeds. Walnuts, almonds, cashews, pistachios, sunflower seeds, pumpkin seeds, unhulled sesame seeds, hemp seeds, flax seeds, and chia seeds. Ingredients for homemade soups. Carrots, celery, garlic, onions, zucchini, fresh and dried herbs, no salt seasoning, leeks, turnips, dried beans, lentils, and split peas. Other staples. Flavored and balsamic vinegars, lemons, juice is great in a salad, soup, or vegetable dish, tomato sauce, no salt added, salsa, no salt added, avocados, tofu, edamame, green soybeans, and old-fashioned rolled oats. Fresh or dried herbs and seasonings. Basil, oregano, dill, parsley, cilantro, chives, rosemary, thyme, ginger, garlic cloves or garlic powder, onion powder, mint, chili powder, cumin, Cajun seasoning, pepper, curry powder, cinnamon, Mrs. Dash, and Dr. Furman's Veggie Zest or Matto Zest. The following menus and recipes are examples of diets and dishes rich in nutrients and fiber, consistent with the basic principles of healthful eating. I have included my favorite recipes and those that have become the most popular with my readers and patients. These recipes are among the highest rated at my member center at drfurman.com.
You now have the knowledge that you need to eat to live. Much of this information may be new and contradictory to what you've learned in the past. The questions and answers that follow are intended to solidify and reinforce what I've covered and help you clear up any uncertainties. First, should I take vitamins and other nutritional supplements? I often recommend that people take sensibly designed, high-quality vitamin and mineral supplements to ensure that they get enough vitamin D, vitamin B12, zinc, and iodine. It's also a good idea to take supplemental omega-3 fatty acids or DHA. Very few individuals eat perfectly, and some of us require more of certain nutrients than others, so it makes sense to be sure to ingest adequate amounts of all these important substances. Deficiency of vitamin D, the sunshine vitamin, is very common. Many of us avoid sun exposure, wear sunscreen daily, or spend most of our time indoors. Recent studies indicate that average serum vitamin D levels of Americans have dropped in the past decade. This drop was associated with an overall increase in vitamin D insufficiency in nearly 3 of 4 adolescent and adult Americans. Avoiding the sun may protect against skin damage, but a vitamin D deficiency can contribute to the progression of osteoporosis. It's also been associated with higher rates of certain cancers and autoimmune diseases. A 2009 meta-analysis of 19 studies established a strong inverse relationship between circulating vitamin D levels and breast cancer. Women in the highest vitamin D range reduced the risk of breast cancer by 45%. Another 2009 review of 25 studies found that sufficient vitamin D levels were consistently associated with reduced risk of colorectal cancer. Vitamin B12 helps make red blood cells and keeps your nervous system working properly. It is found mainly in foods of animal origin. Although individuals whose diets are low in animal products dramatically reduce their risk of developing certain diseases and increase life expectancy, they need a supplemental source of vitamin B12. Some people are unable to absorb the vitamin B12 found naturally in food, particularly those in the over 50 age group. And so a supplement is often necessary to optimize immune function, especially in older people. I also instruct my patients to avoid salt, which is iodinated. Since salt is the primary source of iodine in most people's diets, a multivitamin can ensure adequate iodine intake for those who avoid salt. It is also a good idea to take some extra DHA. This essential fatty acid is known for its importance in healthy brain function and cardioprotection. It's naturally converted from the omega-3 fats found in certain green vegetables, walnuts, flax seeds, chia seeds, and hemp seeds. But studies show that people have varying abilities to make this conversion. Many cannot derive enough of these essential fatty acids from natural food sources, and men generally convert less than women, especially as they age. But the main problem with taking typical supplements is that they may expose you to extra nutrients that you do not need. More is not always better. While most people can certainly benefit from a sensibly designed multivitamin plus additional vitamin D and omega-3 fatty acids, it's important to make the right choices because excessive quantities of some vitamin and minerals can be toxic or have long-term negative effects. Avoid taking supplements that contain these ingredients. First of all, vitamin A. Second, high-dose vitamin E, such as 200 IUs or greater. Third, folic acid. Fourth, beta-carotene. And fifth, copper. Ingesting vitamin A or beta-carotene from supplements instead of food may interfere with the absorption of other crucially important carotenoids, such as lutein and lycopene, thus potentially increasing your cancer risk. Folic acid is the synthetic form of folate added to food or used as an ingredient in a vitamin supplement. Folate is found naturally in fruits, vegetables, grains, and other foods. Too much folate obtained naturally from food is not a concern. It comes naturally packaged in balance with other micronutrients, and the body regulates its absorption. Everyone, including pregnant women, should be getting adequate amounts of folate from natural plant sources. Recently, there's been some troubling studies connecting folic acid supplementation and cancer. More and more evidence suggests that folic acid supplementation may significantly increase the risk of cancer. Remember, dietary supplements are supplements, not substitutes for a healthy diet. Supplements alone cannot offer optimal protection against disease, and you cannot make an unhealthy diet into a healthy one by consuming supplements. The next question is, could restricting my intake of animal products or eating a strict vegetarian diet cause me to develop vitamin deficiencies? A strict vegetarian diet is deficient in meeting the vitamin B12 needs of some individuals. If you choose to follow a complete vegetarian or vegan diet, it's imperative that you consume a multivitamin or other source of B12, such as fortified soy milk. My vegetarian menu plans and dietary suggestions are otherwise rich in calcium and contain sufficient iron from green vegetables and beans. They contain adequate protein and are extremely nutrient dense. My observations suggest that vegetarians would be foolish to not play it safe either by taking a B12 supplement or a multivitamin, or by consuming foods that have been fortified with vitamin B12. Another option for those who loathe taking vitamins is to have their blood checked periodically. Checking your B12 level alone is most often not sufficient. Your methylmalonic acid, or MMA, must also be checked to accurately gauge if the level of B12 in your body is enough for you. The next question is, what about supplements or herbs to help me lose weight? Don't be conned by diet pills, magic in a bottle, or fat absorbers. Anything really effective is not safe, and those that are safe are not effective. To deal with the real problem, you must make real changes. What about drugs for weight loss? Remember, for anything to be effective, you have to be on it forever. Even if the drugs were remarkably effective, you'd have to be prepared to stay on them for the rest of your life. The minute you stop, the benefits would slowly be lost. In the long run, it's still your diet that determines your health and your weight. The amphetamine-related appetite suppressants have received much press, and they were quite popular until their dangers became better known. They were never approved for long-term use, so it wasn't very wise for people to use them. The two FDA-approved drugs for weight reduction are Meridia and Zenical. Meridia can cause headaches, insomnia, constipation, dry mouth, hypertension, and is only slightly helpful. And Zenical, the fat inhibitor, can cause abdominal pain and diarrhea, and it reduces absorption of the fat-soluble vitamins such as D, E, and K. It may help those who consume an unhealthy, fatty diet, but even then, it's hardly worth the side effects. Overall, drugs are drugs. They are a poor substitute for healthy living. Now the question is, people are thinking, can I eat chocolate, ice cream, or other junk food ever again? And here's the thing. You can eat anything you desire on occasion, but just don't make a habit of it. And remember, I want you to be very strict for the first 3 months in order to document how much weight you can expect to lose when you eat sensibly. We're all tempted by these treats. But it's easier to resist if you get them out of your house completely. All cheating should be done outside of your home. If possible, associate with friends who will support you in recovering your health, or may join you in trying to be healthy. You see, once you regain your health and you feel great, you're less likely to crave these foods or be so tempted. Then when you do deviate from a healthful diet, it is likely you'll feel poorly, have a persistent dry mouth, or not sleep well. And if you go off your diet and eat junk food on occasion, mark it on your calendar and consider it a special occasion that you won't repeat too often. Nobody is perfect. However, do not let your weight yo-yo. You must adhere to the plan strictly enough so that you never put back on whatever weight you do take off. Is exercise essential for success in weight loss? And what type of exercise is best? That's an often asked question. And exercise is important. But if your ability to be active or an exercise is limited, don't despair. My more aggressive menu plans will still enable you to lose weight. Obviously, those unable to exercise require a stricter diet. Some people have health conditions that preclude them from exercising much. However, you should still try to devise an exercise prescription to fit your capabilities. Almost everyone can do something. Even those who cannot walk can do arm exercises with light weights and use an arm cycle. Exercise will facilitate your weight loss and make you healthier. Vigorous exercise has a powerful effect on promoting longevity. If you have the will to adopt this plan and take good care of yourself, you will find the will to exercise. No time to exercise is not an excuse. If you have time to brush your teeth, take a shower, or go to the bathroom, you can make some time to exercise. Take frequent 5-minute exercise breaks. Walk stairs. Or stand up and sit down slowly in your chair 20 times. Even people with no time to exercise or join a health club can go up and down stairs in their home or place of work. Walking 20 or more flights a day is an effective way to achieve your goal. Most of my patients have a health club in their house, that is, a stairway leading to the upstairs floor and one going down to the basement as well. I ask them to walk up and down the 2 flights 10 times in the morning before they shower and 10 times at night. It only takes 5 minutes, but it really works. I also encourage patients to join a real health club and use a variety of equipment to utilize many body parts for maximum results. The more muscle groups that are exercised, the more metabolically active players you have on your team to help you meet your goals. It is definitely helpful to have access to an assortment of exercise equipment, such as elliptical machines, treadmills, steppers, recumbent bicycles, and numerous resistance machines. When you tire of one machine, you can move on to another. The next question, are there other strategies for success in the weight loss arena? This is not a book on stress management, social support, or stimulus control. Entire books have been written on these subjects. Clearly, it is difficult to eat healthfully in our crazy world where it seems that everyone else is on a mission to commit suicide with food. That said, some of the following suggestions have proven helpful for people trying to lose weight. Social support. Include family and friends in your plan. Ask others to read this book, not just with the purpose of recruiting them to this way of eating, but so they will help you and understand why you are eating this way. If they're truly your friends, they'll support you in your desire to improve your health and will try to have the right food choices available when you are around. Maybe they'll even join you on your quest. It's extremely helpful to find at least one friend to join you or support you on your road back to superior health. Stimulus control. Implement strategies to prevent temptation and exposure to sedentary activities or social eating. The most important stimulus control technique is structuring your environment. This means removing temptation from your home and stocking your cupboards and refrigerator with the proper foods. Eat only at the kitchen table, not while watching television. When you finish dinner, clean up and leave the kitchen area. Then brush and floss your teeth so you're not tempted to return and snack again. Lay out your exercise clothing for the morning so you're reminded to begin your day with your exercise program. When going out to social situations, eat first or bring your own food if you cannot arrange in advance to have food that meets your needs. Volunteer to bring food for the other guests too. Then you'll have something you can eat without distress. Try not to make food the center of your life. Keep active with interests that keep you from thinking about eating all the time. Positive visualization and other relaxation techniques. Progressive muscle relaxation and meditation are designed to reduce tension and to provide a distraction for stressful events. For many, stress is a predictor of relapse and unhealthy eating. We need both exercise and sufficient rest and sleep to deal best with the stresses in our life. If you're not sleeping well, you can become overwhelmed more easily by stressful situations. An audio tape or CD to guide you in relaxation can be very helpful in reducing stress and sleeping better. Self-monitoring. Accept that this diet is a lifetime commitment. The individual most likely to succeed is one who has changed both his habits and his mindset. Food diaries, weekly weigh-ins, physical activity logs, and goal setting are all effective ways to stay on track. The primary purpose of self-monitoring is to become aware of behaviors and factors that either positively or negatively influences your food and activity choices. Research has consistently demonstrated that self-monitoring is a helpful tool that improves outcome. So I suggest you make a list of goals that losing weight will help you accomplish and post it somewhere in your home where you'll see it. Add to it from time to time and check off accomplishments as you achieve them. Make the goals very specific to you, such as the following. I will be confident about my ability to resist disease. I will succeed at losing pounds and regaining excellent health. I will be able to fit into fashionable clothes, including my favorite blue dress. My cholesterol will improve by at least 50 points. I will look good in a bathing suit at the pool this summer. I'll have more energy and be able to enjoy bike trips with my children. My job will be less tiring, and I'll perform better and make more money. I'll save money on health care, and I'll be able to save for my retirement. I'll have a better social life. I'll be in a position to attract John or Jane. My knees and back will stop hurting. I'll gain the respect of my peers. My allergies, constipation, indigestion, headaches, and acne will all resolve. My fears about a health crisis or death will subside. And of course, all your own ideas. Additional support from Dr. Furman, of course, me. I've created a website to provide additional information, tools, and support to help you accomplish your goals. At drfurman.com, you'll have access to the most current information on health and nutrition, as well as to more inspiring and dramatic stories of sustained weight loss and health recoveries. You can find articles I've written making sense of recent research findings on nutritional medicine, sifting through the myths versus the facts. It's the best place to find out about my upcoming lectures and events. Every year I organize a week-long health getaway, which gives you the opportunity to be fully engaged in receiving information critical to your health, enjoy and learn how to make gourmet nutritarian recipes, and develop lifelong friendships with supportive like-minded people. The getaway offers lectures, cooking demos, exercise classes, and health screenings, along with activities and entertainment in a beautiful resort setting. In other words, a great vacation. The membership at drfurman.com is specifically designed to ensure your success, whether you need guidance and encouragement or just want to enjoy the information and camaraderie there. Members can turn to the website for ongoing insight, recipes, meal plans, social networking, and even my personal advice. You can read my answers to thousands of questions and ask me your questions too. In addition, you'll have the opportunity to connect directly with other members who are just starting out or who have been successful and can pass along helpful tips. Remember, you will reach your goals more quickly when you have the support of others who already achieved success. structured coaching. Some individuals do better when another person tracks their results and provides encouragement. Some people maximize success with a variety of aids, including regular visits to a doctor, dietitian, or psychologist. When patients see me each month, we review what they've achieved and what it will take to achieve the goal for the following month. Improvements in blood pressure, weight, lipid levels, liver function, and diabetic parameters are all helpful to keep people focused on achieving their goals. If you're on medication, you'll have to visit your physician regularly to adjust the dose and potentially discontinue a medication that you will no longer need as you lose weight. You can also ask your physician to read this book and work with you, supporting you as you earn your way back to total wellness. Inpatient facilities or health retreats. If you do not succeed or are not able to do so on your own, you're still not a failure. Some individuals require a structured environment to get them started on the road to success. For others, it's imperative for their health that they succeed at taking weight off relatively quickly. If you're committed to success, then there's no reason you should be satisfied with anything less than spectacular results in your health, wellness, and physique. Some individuals may require an initial period of supervision that offers a more disciplined and structured program in which all the food they eat is prepared for them. These people are soon re-educated in proper eating and learn to adjust to the changes they must make. They can taste many different ways to prepare healthy food and then learn healthy food preparation. The next question, is a vegetarian or vegan diet healthier than a diet that contains just a small amount of animal products? And the answer is, I do not know for sure. A preponderance of the evidence suggests that either a near vegetarian diet or a vegetarian diet is the best. In the massive China Cornell Oxford Project, a reduction in cancer rates continued to be observed as participants reduced their animal food consumption all the way down to one serving per week. But below this level, there's not enough data available. Some smaller studies suggest that some fish added to a vegetarian or vegan diet provides benefit, which is likely a result of the increased DHA fat from fish. The same benefit most likely could be achieved on a strict vegetarian diet by including ground flax seeds and nuts that contain omega-3, such as walnuts. If you want to get the benefits from the additional DHA contained in fish, yet remain on a strict vegetarian diet, you can also take an algae-derived DHA. Whether or not you are a strict vegetarian, your diet must be plant-predominant for optimal health and to maximally reduce your cancer risk. A vegetarian or vegan diet may be healthy or unhealthy depending on food choices, but a diet similar to the one most Americans consume, one that contains such a significant quantity of animal products, cannot be made healthful. For those not willing to give them up, animal products should be limited to 12 ounces or less per week. Otherwise, the risk of disease increases considerably. Many of my patients choose to eat only vegan foods in their home and eat animal products as a treat once a week or even less when they're out. The next question, is a high-nutrient, low-calorie diet, the one I recommend, the best for everyone? I do not recommend the same diet for everyone, but the H equals N over C formula never changes. On very rare occasions, I come across an individual who requires some modification to this diet. There are some illnesses, such as active inflammatory bowel disease, for which this diet would have to be adjusted because the patient may not tolerate a large amount of raw vegetables and fruits. And I do adjust and customize eating plans and nutritional supplementation for individuals with unique medical and metabolic needs. If you are one such person, or if you need a healthful way to gain weight, I would hope you would contact me or another physician with expertise in this area for more specific advice. The next question is, I don't drink 6 to 8 glasses of water daily. Is that bad? Only those eating an American-style diet so high in salt and so low in the high water content fruits and vegetables need to drink that much water. On my fiber and fluid-rich diet, your need for extra water decreases dramatically. 3 glasses a day is usually sufficient, but if you're exercising or in the heat, then you obviously need to drink more to replenish those liquids lost through perspiration. The next question is, how do you modify your recommendations about nutrition and disease prevention for children or those not needing to lose weight? I believe the diet that we currently feed our children is the reason we are seeing so many frequent infections and such a high level of allergies, autoimmune disease, and even cancer in this country. Unfortunately, what we eat early in life has a more powerful effect on our eventual health or ill health than what we eat later in life. I have 4 children, and I understand the difficulties of trying to raise healthy children in today's insane food world. It seems we're in an environment in which parents are enthusiastically and purposely breeding a nation of sickly and diseased adults. In my community, parents and neighbors unknowingly attempt to poison their children at every opportunity. They don't merely feed their own children a diet chock full of sugar and fat, but at every birthday party, athletic event, and social occasion, they bring cupcakes and candy for the entire crowd. You know, I would expect that as a parent, we all have the same goal of trying to get our children to eat more nutritious food, more vegetables, fruits, raw nuts and seeds, legumes or beans. However, no child will eat healthfully if he or she is allowed to eat unhealthy foods on a regular basis. The only way to have a child eat healthfully is to clear all unhealthful foods out of the house so that when the child is hungry, he or she is forced to pick from healthful choices. Children will at least eat healthfully at home if they're presented with only healthy food choices. And for more information, consider reading my book, Disease Proof Your Child, which is, of course, a lot about this. But the dietary rules in this book are too calorie-restricted and too fat-restricted for a child or for a thin athlete. However, the principles for healthy eating and longevity do not change. All that has to be done to increase the caloric density and fat density of the diet is to add more wholesome sources of fat and calories, such as raw nuts and seeds, nut butters and avocados. Starchy vegetables and whole grains can be consumed in larger amounts, and vegetables and grain dishes can be flavored with sauces and dressings made with nuts and seeds. If you want to gain weight, eating more or eating differently to bulk up will usually add mostly fat to your body. It's exceptionally rare for a person to gain more muscle just from eating more food. Forcing yourself to consume more food than your body wants is not in your best interest. If you want to gain weight, lift weights to add muscle, then the exercise will increase your appetite accordingly. When you eat a healthful diet, nature has you carry only that mass that you need. Your muscles will enlarge only if additional stress is placed on them. Of course, this book is designed for those who are overweight and desirous of losing weight. Those who are truly excessively thin and need to gain weight may have to modify this eating plan somewhat to meet their individual needs. The next question is it dangerous to eat more fruits and vegetables because of the increased consumption of pesticides, and do I have to buy organic? This is controversial. The effects of ingesting pesticides in the very small amounts present in vegetation are unknown. Bruce Ames, PhD, director of the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences Center at the University of California at Berkeley, who's devoted his career to examining this question, believes these minute amounts pose no risk at all. He and other scientists support this view because humans and other animals are exposed to small amounts of naturally occurring toxins with every mouthful of organically grown natural food. The body normally breaks down self-produced metabolic wastes and naturally occurring carcinogens in foods, as well as pesticides, and excretes these harmful substances every minute. And since 99.9% of the potential carcinogenic chemicals consumed are naturally present in all food, reducing our exposure to that last 0.01% that are synthetic will not reduce cancer rates. These scientists argue that humans ingest thousands of natural chemicals that typically have a greater toxicity that are present at higher dosage than the very small amounts of pesticide residues that still remain on the food. Furthermore, animal studies on the carcinogenic potential of synthetic chemicals are done at dosages 1,000-fold higher than what's ingested in food. Ames argues that a high percentage of all chemicals, natural or not, are potentially toxic in high dosages. Of course, the dose makes the poison, and that there's no evidence that a possible cancer hazard from even the tiny chemical residue remaining on produce. Others believe a slight risk may be present, though that risk might be difficult to prove. There is certainly a justifiable concern that some chemicals have increased toxicity and are potentially harmful at lower doses than are used in rodent experiments. No scientist believes that this means we should reduce our consumption of vegetation, but many, including me, believe it prudent to reduce our exposure to the multiple toxic residues present in our food supply. I certainly advocate avoiding the skins of foods that are reported to have the most pesticide residue. And of course, all fruits and vegetables should be washed before eating. If you're concerned about pesticides and chemicals, keep in mind that animal products, such as dairy and beef, contain the most toxic pesticide residues. Because cows and steers eat large amounts of tainted feed, certain pesticides and dangerous chemicals are found in higher concentrations in animal foods. For example, dioxin, which is predominantly found in fatty meats and dairy products, is one of the most potent toxins linked to several cancers in humans, including lymphomas. By basing your diet on unrefined whole plant foods, you automatically reduce your exposure to the most dangerous chemicals. According to the Environmental Working Group, these are the Dirty Dozen, consistently most contaminated fruits and vegetables ranked from highest to lowest. So, of course, it would make sense to purchase organically grown versions of these foods. They are celery, peaches, strawberries, apples, blueberries, nectarines, bell peppers, spinach, cherries, kale, potatoes, and, of course, imported grapes. That means that onions, sweet corn, asparagus, peas, cabbage, eggplant, broccoli, tomatoes, and sweet potatoes are vegetables least likely to have pesticide on them. Avocados, pineapples, mangoes, kiwi, papayas, watermelon, and grapefruit are the fruits least likely to have pesticide residue on them. And of course, most of these have thick skins that are peeled and thrown away anyway. It makes good sense to peel fruits if possible and not eat potato skins unless you're able to purchase pesticide-free potatoes. Remove and discard the outermost leaves of lettuce and cabbage if not organically grown. Other surfaces that cannot be peeled can be washed with soap and water or a commercial vegetable wash. Washing with plain water removes 25 to 50% of the pesticide residue. Every study done to date on the consumption of food on its relation to cancer has shown that the more fruits and vegetables people eat, the less cancer and heart disease they have. And all of these studies were done on people eating conventionally grown, not organic produce. So clearly the benefits of conventional produce outweigh any hypothetical risk. The next question is, my doctor noted that my complexion had turned yellowish and told me to cut back on foods containing carotene, such as mangoes, carrots, and sweet potato. The slight yellow-orange tinge to your skin is not a problem. It is a marker that you're on a healthy diet. So on the contrary, any person who does not have some degree of carotenemia in his or her skin is not eating properly, and such an eating pattern places him or her at a risk of cancer, including skin cancer. I don't drink carrot juice. However, my skin has a slight yellow hue, especially when contrasted with the skin of people eating conventionally. When my patients eat a nutritionally packed diet, their skin color changes slightly as well. Tell your doctor it is he who has the dangerous skin tone. However, I still do not recommend taking vitamin A or high doses of beta-carotene in supplements. Both vitamin A and beta-carotene in supplemental form have been linked to increased mortality. The next question is, what about the argument about our ancestors being hunter-gatherers who ate lots of meat? Of course, there were primitive populations who ate high meat diets, and there were primitive populations who ate plant-predominant diets. Humans were desperate for calories, so they ate whatever they could get their hands on. The two questions we have to look at are these: how long do they live on that diet? And what diet for humans gives them the best protection against disease and the greatest chance for longevity in modern times? Personally, I want to do a lot better than our prehistoric ancestors did. A comprehensive overview and a sensible interpretation of the scientific evidence supports the conclusion that we can increase human longevity and prevent disease if we make specific food choices. We still retain our primate physiology, a physiology that depends on high vegetable consumption, which is relevant to explain our ability to thrive on a plant-predominant diet. Dr. Catherine Milton at the University of California at Berkeley is among the few nutritional anthropologists in the world who's worked with and studied cultures and primitive peoples that are not influenced by modern technology. And she's concluded that the diet of both primitive people and wild primates is largely plant-based. But the main difference between primitive diets and our own is their consumption of nutrient-dense wild plants and the lack of access to low-nutrient, high-fat foods such as cheese, oil, and also the lack of access to refined grains. Now we have a unique opportunity in human history. We have fresh produce being sent into our food stores from all over the planet. We can take advantage of this abundant variety of fresh vegetation to eat a diet with more phytochemical density and diversity than ever before. We have the opportunity to make decisions about what we eat that were not available to our prehistoric ancestors. Fortunately, we have knowledge that they lacked, and we can use this knowledge to live longer than ever before. The next question is, I know you do not recommend butter or margarine, so what do we put on bread and vegetables? That's right. Butter is loaded with a dangerous amount of saturated fat, and stick margarines have hydrogenated oils that contain trans fats, which raises LDL, the bad cholesterol. The more solid a margarine is at room temperature, the more trans fat it contains. Adjusting the type of fat consumed, researchers found that butter caused the highest cholesterol levels, and that varying amounts of margarines and oils had also harmful effects. So the best answer is to use nothing or to buy whole grain bread that tastes good without adding a greasy topping. And if you love the flavor of butter, then just sparingly use the tub or liquid margarines that contain no hydrogenated oil. You can just use a little bit. And lots of my patients like the no-salt tomato sauce, a tomato salsa blend, avocado, or stewed mushrooms on bread. Of course, the best way to get out of the habit of eating those greasy toppings is to not eat bread at all. What about soy? The next question is, are soy products and soybeans a healthy food to eat? Soy products, such as soy burgers, soy milk, and soy cheese, are much more popular and available today than in the past. The FDA has approved soy-containing products as heart healthy and allows health claims for soy protein. Studies have shown soy's beneficial effects on cholesterol and other cardiovascular risk factors. However, there's no reason not to expect the same results from beans of any type. It's merely that more studies have been done on soy than on other beans. So there are numerous studies indicating that soybeans are rich in various anti-cancer compounds, such as isoflavones. In spite of popular myths, the scientific literature is clear. The consumption of soybeans or minimally processed soy products such as tofu and tempeh is linked to reduced risk of breast cancer. However, I do not recommend consuming large quantities of soy products in the hopes of reducing cancer risk. The soybean is not the only bean that contains isoflavones. Most beans are rich in these beneficial anti-cancer compounds, and many different flavonoids with anti-cancer effects are found in beans of all kinds. A healthy diet includes a variety of beans and does not rely on any one food for a disproportionate share of calories. I always recommend the consumption of a broad variety of phytochemical-rich foods to maximize one's health, and of course, beans are no exception. Tofu and frozen soybeans are good sources of omega-3 fat and calcium, but soy nuts, soy milk, and other processed soy products do not retain much of the beneficial compounds found in the natural bean. The more the food is processed, the more the beneficial compounds are destroyed. Most processed soy products can be tasty additions to a plant-based diet, but they're generally high in salt and are not nutrient-dense foods, so you should use them very sparingly. In conclusion, the soybean is a superior food containing the difficult-to-find omega-3 fats, but beans in general are superior foods that fight against cancer and heart disease, which is why you will benefit from including a variety of beans in your diet. The next question is, how much salt is permissible on this nutritional program? This book is designed for those who want to lose weight and for those who want to maintain excellent health and prevent disease. Any excess salt added to food outside of what is contained in natural foods is likely to increase your risk of developing disease. Salt consumption is linked to both stomach cancer and hypertension. So for optimal health, I recommend that no salt at all be added to any food. The famous DASH study clearly indicates that Americans consume 5 to 10 times as much sodium as they need, and that high sodium levels over the years raise blood pressure. Just because you don't have high blood pressure now doesn't mean that you won't. In fact, you probably will have high blood pressure if you keep eating lots of salt. But salt also pulls out calcium and other trace minerals in the urine when the excess is excreted, which is a contributory cause of osteoporosis. If that is not enough, high sodium intake is predictive of increased death from heart attacks. In a large prospective trial published in the respected medical journal Lancet, there was a frighteningly high correlation between sodium intake and all-cause mortality in overweight men, the researchers concluded that high sodium intake predicted mortality and risk of coronary heart disease independent of other cardiovascular risk factors, including high blood pressure. These results provide direct evidence of the harmful effects of high salt intake in adult populations. This means that salt has a significant harmful effect independent of its effect on blood pressure. For instance, it very likely increases the tendency of platelets to clot. I recommend that people resist adding salt to foods and look for no salt-added products. Since most salt comes from processed foods, bread, and canned goods, it shouldn't be that hard to avoid added sodium. That said, if you desire to salt your food, do so only after it is on the table and you're ready to eat it. It will taste saltier if the salt is right on the surface of the food. You can add lots of salt to vegetables or soups while they are cooking, yet hardly taste it. Use herbs, spices, lemon juice, vinegar, and other no-salt seasonings to flavor food. Condiments, such as ketchup, mustard, soy sauce, teriyaki sauce, and relish, are very high in sodium. So if you can't resist them, use a low-sodium variety and use them very sparingly. Ideally, all your food should have less than 1 milligram of sodium per calorie. Natural foods contain about 0.5 milligram of sodium per calorie. So if food has a serving size of 100 calories and contains 400 milligrams of sodium, that's a very high salt food. If the serving has 100 calories and less than 100 milligrams of sodium, it's a food with hardly any added salt and is an appropriate food for your diet. Try to avoid products with more than 200 milligrams of sodium per 100 calories. Within these guidelines, you should be able to keep your average daily sodium intake around or below 1,000 milligrams a day. If you don't use salt, your taste buds adjust with time, and your ability to taste salt improves. When you're using a lot of salt in your diet, it weakens your taste for salt, and it makes you feel that food tastes bland unless it's heavily seasoned or spiced. The DASH study observed the same phenomenon that I've been noted for years. It takes some time for one's salt-saturated taste buds to get used to a low sodium level. If you follow my nutritional recommendations strictly without compromise, avoiding all processed foods or highly salted foods, your ability to detect and enjoy the subtle flavors in fruits and vegetables will improve as well. The next question is, what about coffee? Clearly, excessive consumption of caffeinated beverages is not healthy and even dangerous. Caffeine addicts are at higher risk of cardiac arrhythmias that could precipitate sudden cardiac death. Coffee also raises blood pressure as well as cholesterol and homocysteine, two risk factors for heart disease. But one cup of coffee a day is not likely to cause a significant risk, but drinking more than one cup can interfere with your health and even your weight loss goals. Besides the increased risk for heart disease, there are two other problems with caffeine. First, it's a stimulant that allows you to get by with less sleep and reduces the depth of sleep. Such sleep deprivation results in a higher level of the stress hormone cortisol and interferes with glucose metabolism, leading to insulin resistance. This insulin resistance and the subsequent higher baseline glucose level can further promote heart disease and other problems. Put bluntly, caffeine consumption promotes inadequate sleep, and less sleep promotes disease and premature aging. Adequate sleep is also necessary to prevent overeating. There's no substitute for adequate sleep. The second issue with caffeine is that eating more frequently and eating more food suppresses caffeine withdrawal headaches and other withdrawal symptoms. When you're finally finished digesting a meal, the body more effectively cleans house. At this time, caffeine addicts experience a drive to eat more to suppress caffeine withdrawal symptoms. Thus, they are prodded to eat more food than they would have if they are not addicted to caffeine. You'll never be in touch with your body's true hunger signals while you're addicted to stimulants. For some people, giving up coffee is more difficult than following the dietary restrictions I recommend. I suggest that you carefully adhere to my recommendations without caffeinated beverages for the first 6 weeks. After that time, when the addiction to caffeine is no longer present, you can decide if you really can't give up that one cup of coffee. Keep in mind that it takes 4 to 5 days for the caffeine withdrawal headaches to resolve once you stop drinking coffee. If the symptoms are too severe,
Try reducing your coffee intake slowly by about half a cup every 3 days. But if a little coffee would make it possible for you to remain true to my dietary recommendations, I would not have a strong objection. Losing weight is a much more important goal for your overall health. It's just that higher amounts of caffeine do not make it easier to control your appetite and food cravings. They make it harder. It would be much better if you gave this plan a true test. See how well you feel, how much weight you can lose in 6 weeks. Maybe by then you will have lost your cravings for mind-altering substances. The next question is, how much alcohol is permissible? Moderate drinking has been associated with lower incidence of coronary heart disease in more than 40 prospective studies. This applies only to moderate drinking, defined as one drink or less per day for a woman and two drinks or less for men. More than this is associated with increased fat around the waist and other potential problems. Alcohol consumption also leads to mild withdrawal sensations the next day that are commonly mistaken for hunger. So one glass of wine per day is likely insignificant, but I advise against higher levels of alcohol consumption. Alcohol's anti-clotting properties grant some protective effects against heart attacks, but this protective effect is valuable only in a person or populations consuming a heart disease-promoting diet. It's much wiser to avoid the detrimental effects of alcohol completely and protect yourself from heart disease with nutritional excellence. For example, even moderate alcohol consumption is linked to higher rates of breast cancer and to the occurrence of atrial fibrillation. Avoid alcohol and eat healthfully if possible, but if that one drink a day will make you stay with a plan much more successfully, then of course have it. The next question is, I feel best when I eat a high-protein diet with plenty of animal products. Does that mean these recommendations to eat a plant-based diet are not for me? I have thousands of patients eating vegetarian or near-vegetarian diets, and over the last 15 years, I've noted a very small percentage of the total who initially report that they feel better with a significant animal product in their diet, and they feel worse on a vegetarian diet. But almost all these complaints resolve with time on the new diet, and I believe the main reasons for this are as follows. A diet heavily burdened with animal products places a toxic stress on the detoxification systems of the body. As with stopping caffeine, cigarettes, and heroin, many observe withdrawal symptoms for a short period, including fatigue, weakness, headaches, or loose stool. But in 95% of these cases, these symptoms resolve within 2 weeks. It's more common that the temporary adjustment period lasts less than a week, during which you might feel fatigue, have headaches or gas, or experience other mild symptoms as your body withdraws from your prior toxic habits. So don't buy the fallacy that you need more protein. The menus in this book offer sufficient protein, and protein deficiency does not cause fatigue anyway. Even my vegan menus supply about 50 grams of protein per 1,000 calories. It's a whopping amount. Stopping dangerous but stimulating foods causes temporary fatigue. Increased gas and loose stool are also occasionally observed when switching to a diet containing so much fiber and different fibers that the digestive tract has never encountered before. Over many years, the body has adjusted its secretions and peristaltic waves to a low-fiber diet, and these symptoms will also improve with time. Chewing extra well, sometimes even blending salads, helps in this period of transition. And some people must avoid beans initially and then use them in only very small amounts, adding more to the diet gradually over a period of weeks to train the digestive tract to handle and digest these new fibers. Other people have increased fat requirements, and the type of vegetarian diet they may have been on in the past was not rich enough in certain essential fats for them. This can occur in those eating a plant-based diet that includes lots of low-fat wheat and grain products. Frequently adding ground flax seeds or flaxseed oil to the diet supplies additional omega-3 fats can be helpful, but some especially very thin individuals require more calories and more fat to sustain their weight. This is usually fixed by including raw nuts, raw nut butters, avocados, and other healthy foods that are nutrient-rich, but also high in fat and calories. Even these naturally thin individuals will significantly improve their health and lower their risk of degenerative diseases if they reduce their dependency on animal foods, and instead, of course, consume more plant-derived fats such as nuts. There is also the rare individual who needs more concentrated sources of protein and fat in their diet because of digestive impairment, Crohn's disease, short gut syndrome, or other uncommon medical conditions.
I've also encountered patients on rare occasions who just become too thin and malnourished on what I would consider an ideal nutrient-dense diet, and on such occasions, more animal products have been needed to reduce the fiber content, slow transit time in the gut, and aid the absorption and concentration of amino acids at each meal. The problem usually is the result of some digestive impairment or difficulty with absorption, and I've only seen a very small handful of such cases in the past 20 years in practice. In other words, not even 1 in 100, in my estimation, requires animal products regularly in their diet. But these individuals should still follow my general recommendations for excellent health and can accommodate their individual needs by keeping animal product consumption down to a comparatively low level. The next question is, do you recommend low-calorie or no-calorie sweeteners? Sweetening agents such as NutraSweet, Sweet and Low, Splenda, are added to thousands of foods and drugs, and many health gurus now recommend substituting stevia in place of artificial sweeteners. Recently approved by the FDA, stevia is made from the leaves of the South American shrub, and of course it can be labeled natural. Many people use these sweeteners in an effort to control their weight, but it doesn't work. It just perpetuates your desire for unhealthy food. When researchers compare the caloric intake of women fed aspartame sweetened drinks with women given higher calorie beverages, the women given the aspartame merely consume more calories later on. The use of non-caloric sweeteners as a calorie restriction strategy continues to be criticized by scientists. It's been suggested that consuming something with a sweet taste primes the body for a calorie delivery that doesn't happen, and as a result, the users of no-calorie sweeteners just seek more sweets to satisfy the body's cravings. The non-caloric sweeteners signal the body that sugar is on the way and stimulate the pancreas to secrete insulin, and that's not favorable. If you're a headache sufferer, beware of products made with aspartame. Studies have shown that migraine sufferers experience more frequent and more severe symptoms after ingesting aspartame. I recommend playing it safe and sticking to natural foods. The safety of all the artificial sweeteners, as well as the natural sugars, has been questioned in one way or another. The bottom line, try to enjoy your food choices without sweeteners, and fresh fruit and occasional, a little date sugar or ground dates or other dried fruit are the safest way to go. I recommend dropping the colas, sodas, sweetened teas, and juices. If they don't contain artificial sweeteners, they're loaded with sugar. Instead, eat unrefined foods and drink water. Melons blended with ice cubes make delicious cooling summer drinks. And I certainly believe that if you are significantly overweight, the risk of being overweight probably exceeds any risk associated with these sweeteners. However, I'm not convinced that many people have found that these low-calorie or no-calorie sweeteners to be the solution to their weight problems. The next question is, well, what about agave nectar? What do you recommend that as a sweetener? And, you know, agave has become the sweetener of choice for many health enthusiasts, but I still do not recommend it. It's just another concentrated, low-nutrient sweetener. In addition, it may pose some significant health problems. One of its claims to fame is its low glycemic index. That's because agave is approximately 85% fructose. Fructose is metabolized differently from other sugars. Instead of going into the bloodstream where it could raise blood sugar, most of it goes directly to the liver. That's why it has a low glycemic index, but it still promotes fat storage and weight gain. While many see a low glycemic index as a positive, fructose or any concentrated sweetener high in fructose can cause elevated triglycerides and increased risk of heart disease. It may also increase the risk of metabolic syndrome, insulin resistance, particularly in those who are insulin resistant or overweight or obese. These are the same reasons we are giving for avoiding products made with high fructose corn syrup, which has more fructose than regular table sugar. The next question is, I eat out frequently, which makes sticking with this plan very difficult. How can I make that transition easier? I want you to choose restaurants that have healthful options and know the places that will cater to your needs. When possible, speak to the management or chef in advance. When traveling, look for restaurants that have salad bars. This is not an all-or-nothing plan. Every person exposed to these ideas can improve over his or her current diet. People have a tendency to like best the foods to which they've become accustomed. Keep in mind that eventually, you will lose the desire for some of the unhealthful foods you are eating now,
and you will enjoy the pleasures of healthy, natural foods more. I actually enjoy eating healthy foods more than injurious foods because they taste good and I also feel good. And most of my patients report the same sensation. Food preferences are learned. You can learn to enjoy healthy foods just as you learn to like the unhealthy ones. You can follow this diet on the road if you are committed to your own success. It just takes more diligence to plan where to eat and to make sure there'll be something for you on the menu. Get in the habit of ordering a double-sized green salad with a dressing on the side and then use only a very tiny amount of the dressing or squeeze some lemon on the salad. Remember that this is not a temporary diet. It's your life plan. We must consider how our health is affected by what we choose to eat. We all have to make wise choices to get the most out of life. That doesn't mean you must be perfect, but it does mean that when you eat, whether you adopt all of my recommendations or just some of them, your health will be better off as a result of those improvements. After a while, it'll become a habit. If you give it a real try, and you may find, as other haves, that it's not as difficult as you thought, and you will likely grow to enjoy it more and more. The next question is, do you think everyone will eventually embrace this healthy way of eating? And of course not. The social and economic forces that are pulling our population toward obesity and disease will not be defeated by one book preaching about achieving superior health with nutritional excellence. The good life will continue to send most Americans to a premature grave. This plan certainly is not for everyone. I don't expect the majority of individuals to live this healthfully. However, they should at least be aware of the facts rather than having their food choices shaped by inaccurate information or food manufacturers. Some people choose to smoke cigarettes, eat unhealthfully, or pursue other reckless habits. They have that inalienable right to live their lives the way they choose. Don't add stress to your life by trying to persuade every person you meet to eat the same way you do. Looking good and feeling healthy will be your best tools of persuasion. A common criticism of my eating plan, which all knowledgeable authorities agree is healthy, is that most people won't stick to such a restrictive regimen. And this is an irrelevant point. Since when is what the masses find socially acceptable the criterion for value? Value or correctness is independent of how many people will choose to follow my recommendations. That's a completely separate issue. The critical question is how effective these recommendations are in guaranteeing a slim body, a long life, and enduring good health. All those naysayers have missed the point. My plan was not designed to win a popularity contest. Thousands of enthusiastic individuals who have benefited from this body of knowledge consider this information a special blessing. It's an opportunity to have your life be so much healthier, happier, and more enjoyable. We don't feel deprived. Rather, we enjoy fantastic tasting food that's also healthy. We've developed a distaste for junk food. At this point in our lives, healthy food simply tastes better. Another question is, how enjoyable is life for those plagued with a multitude of serious medical problems? Choosing to live a healthful or unhealthful lifestyle is a personal decision. But again, this is not an all-or-nothing plan. But as a health professional, it's my job to encourage people to protect their future health. We can't buy good health. We must earn it. We're given only one body in this lifetime. So I encourage you to take proper care of it. Over time, your health and happiness are inescapably linked. You don't get a new body when you destroy your health with disease-causing food. I'm 100% committed to your success and well-being. So please contact me if you encounter roadblocks to recovering your health. I wish you a long life and enduring good health. They can be yours.
This is Professor Ned Sparrow. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged recording of Eat to Live, the amazing nutrient-rich program for fast and sustained weight loss by Joel Fuhrman, MD. Copyright 2003-2011 by Joel Fuhrman, MD. This program was produced by Audiobook Studios. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.